This is Fresh Air. I'm Terry Gross. One of the most praised films that opened in the U.S. this year comes from Romania and won the top prize at the Cannes Film Festival. It's called 4 months, 3 weeks, and 2 days. The title refers to the amount of time one of the main characters, Gabita, is pregnant when she goes for an illegal abortion. The story is mostly told from the point of view of her college roommate, Otilia, who helps arrange the abortion and accompanies Gabita to the hotel room where the abortion is to secretly take place. The movie is set in 1987, in the last days of Nicolae Ceaușescu's communist regime. Ceaușescu made abortion illegal in 1966, shortly after he became president. It remained illegal until the fall of Ceaușescu in the late 1980s. New York Times film critic Manola Dargis described the film as a haunting and haunted intellectual and aesthetic achievement. She writes, quote, "The film deserves to be seen by the largest audience possible, partly because it offers a welcome alternative to the coy, trivializing attitude toward abortion now in vogue in American fiction films, but largely because it marks the emergence of an important new talent in Romanian writer and director Cristian Manju," unquote. Cristian Manju is joining us from Radio Guerrilla in Bucharest, Romania. He was born in 1968, 2 years after abortion was made illegal. He's part of the same generation as the two main characters in his movie. Cristian Manju, welcome to Fresh Air. Before we talk about the filmmaking itself, let's talk about the story and the history behind the story. Abortion was illegal under Ceaușescu. Why was it illegal? Was it a moral issue, or were there other reasons why it was illegal?
No, it wasn't something connected with moral or with religion. It was mostly a decision taken for economical and propagandistic reasons. Abortion was banned in Romania in 1966, and it stayed forbidden until 1989, after the fall of communism. And the main reasons for which Ceaușescu decided this were because for some reason he considered that Romania would become a more important country in the region if it had a bigger population, and he hoped that for the plans that he had for the country regarding agriculture and regarding the industry, he needed a bigger population. And it's important to say that it wasn't only abortion that was banned, it was every kind of contraception which was banned. So basically people were encouraged to have more children, that was the whole point. And for example, abortion was legal after women had 4 children or after the age of 45. But it's important to say that this decision generated a baby boom in Romania from like 1966-67 to 1972. And for example, nothing like religion was involved in this decision because religion during communist times was not encouraged in any way. And one more thing to mention for people that don't know is that we are Orthodox, we are not Catholic.
Not Catholic. Yeah. So do you consider yourself part of that baby boom that happened during the period when abortion was banned?
Well, I am. I mean, technically I know, because this is something that our parents wouldn't hide from us. So I know that I wasn't, like, I don't know, a planned child. It just happened. It's not that our parents wouldn't love us. It's not that my parents didn't love me, but I wasn't a planned child. And later on, I discovered that, you know, in a very special way, there's a certain kind of solidarity among these people. Because we had to face the same kind of difficulties when we were younger. And one of the motivations for which I decided to make this film is that I discovered these people would want to see a story about themselves on screen at some point. And this is much more part of my motivation of making a film about that period than abortion itself. I just thought that abortion is one of the most relevant things that happened to us during that period.
So what are some of the stories that you were told by women friends of yours that became background for the movie?
First of all, you know, I knew that I wanted to make a film that would happen in that period. And then I started looking for stories from that period and asking what would be relevant from what we experienced then. And at some point, I just ran again into this girl that has told me this story some 15 years ago, a story that originally happened in 1987. We just met again on the street, and we just got inside into a coffee shop. And somehow the story came back in conversation with all the emotions and the frustrations that I experienced the first time I heard the story. And I thought, wow, this is relevant for what we experienced. Because thinking back and thinking about the communist period that we experienced, I somehow identified in this absolute lack of moral judgment in connection with pregnancy and abortion, one of the worst things that communism did to us. And I thought, you know, it's really important for all these people belonging to this generation to make a story not about abortion, but about how we spent our 20s, but starting from a story like this. And I sketched the story in a couple of days, and then I knew that I'm going to follow my story. But I started talking with a lot of other people just to make sure that this is not an exceptional story. And something very special happened on the set. You know that normally technicians on the set, they don't necessarily read the script and they're not too much involved in what kind of story you're going to tell. But this time, understanding what the story is about, all of a sudden on the set we started having the first reactions and the first personal stories. And after 2 weeks of shooting, it seemed that everybody my age or a little bit older had a story like this. The focus puller and the electricians, and everybody had a sister, a friend, a mother, or a story like this in the family. And later on, this continued after the first public screenings in Romania. And it was this lady from Sibiu, after one of the first screenings, that told us the story. She had a good friend in Sibiu, and this was somewhere in the 70s, and this friend of hers decided to get married. But just before the wedding, she fought and she split with her boyfriend, and she knew that she was pregnant already. And it was unconceivable in the 70s for a girl of 21 in a small town like Sibiu, in the countryside somehow, to have a single child and to have the means to raise it. So she knew that she absolutely needed to appeal and have an abortion. But she couldn't find anybody brave enough in that town to perform this abortion to her. She wasn't necessarily very well connected. And finally, she heard about somebody that was living in a village some 50 kilometers away. So she went to that person, and that person took her to a basement. And in that basement, he had two big barrels. And he told her from the beginning, this is the table where I'm going to perform this abortion. And in these barrels is water in one of them. So if everything goes okay, you're going to wash yourself and you're going to walk back home. But if things don't go well, I'm going to put you in this other barrel with acid. And I'm going to bury you somewhere and nobody will ever hear about you. And I'm telling you this beforehand so you decide what you want to do. And she decided on the spot to just continue and keep on going with the abortion. And she's one of the lucky ones that survived. But supposedly, statistics say that nearly 500,000 women died because of having illegal abortion from 1966 to 1989.
Well, I have to say, the way you show how the abortion is done in the movie, it's amazing that anyone could survive it. Completely not sterile procedure. How you could walk away with that without getting an infection is unimaginable.
Well, if you watch the procedure in detail, they were using alcohol or something like this.
Yeah, but
for example,
he's putting everything on a little piece of gauze on a hotel
table.
Absolutely. You know?
But this is also my way of mentioning that we're not talking about a professional. Because people would say that this is a doctor, and they would call this character in the film the doctor. But actually, it's never mentioned that he's a doctor.
No, exactly. About the movie to friends, I say the abortionist, and I say the reason why I'm calling him an abortionist is because there's no reason to believe he's actually a doctor. He just performs abortions.
And what he's doing over there, it's a little bit of a voodoo. It's not clear. It's just faking that he's a professional. But actually this, you know, most of the people doing things like this were not professionals. And the way this went was like this. Somebody like this guy or somebody in your family would start this, would provoke a bleeding, basically. And after that moment, you had to call for the ambulance because it was a process that couldn't be stopped. And normally they would take you to a hospital and somebody qualified would continue and finish this thing up. Problem is that, especially after 1975, doctors in hospitals were obliged to call the police before doing this because everybody knew that abortion is illegal. And in the last years of the regime, the situation was really very harsh. And they wouldn't allow the doctors to operate you and to make their intervention before you told them who did this to you. And this is why lots of women died, because very often it was somebody so close that you wouldn't turn in somebody from your family.
Did you have friends who died as a result of abortions?
Well, recently we discovered that this project got financed because from the jury of five people that had to read it, there was a lady that had some problems like this, and there was a guy that whose sister has died because of having illegal abortions. And they were the two members of the jury that were very impressed and decided that this screenplay is going to become a film. And later on we discovered that we have a very good friend and film critic that was a supporter of the project from the beginning. And we never knew too much of his biography in detail. But his story is that, you know, when he was six in the morning, his mother kissed him and he went and she said, bye, I'm going to come back at 2 o'clock. I'm going to make this small visit. And apparently she went to have an illegal abortion, which went wrong. And she never came back and nobody told him anything until the age of 16. She just vanished. She disappeared and his father had a nervous breakdown. So he was raised by his grandparents.
My guest is Christian Manju, the writer and director of the new film 4 Months, 3 Weeks, and 2 Days. We'll talk more after a break. This is Fresh Air. If you're just joining us, my guest is Christian Manju. He's speaking to us from Romania. He wrote and directed the new film 4 Months, 3 Weeks, and 2 Days, which won the top prize at the Cannes Film Festival. Now, your film is kind of like a suspense film. It's about a woman having an abortion, a college student having an abortion, her roommate who makes the arrangements and helps her through it, the abortionist who performs the abortion. But the movie's done kind of like a suspense film. It's not an action film, but it's so suspenseful because every step of the way, you know that there are grave things that can happen, from imprisonment to death as a result of infection. And because this is all through the black market underground, there's all kinds of consequences that could happen as a result of that. Do you see the movie as, in its own way, a suspense film?
Well, it is a suspense film, but it is a suspense film in the sense that what I wanted to do is to make you see this story from the perspective of the main character. We deal with this in a different way. I thought, whose perspective do I have to tell in the story? And it was quite obvious for me that the main character in the story is not the Gabica, the girl that finally will have the abortion, but it's her friend, is Otilia, because she would understand something after this day. And because she is the girl that told me the story originally. It was the girl that was helping her friend, and it was very important for me to preserve the key moments of the story. And the most important thing was to try and make spectators experience what she was experiencing in that day. And from her perspective, if you think, everything was possible and she couldn't know what's going to be the result of that day. And this is why I wanted to design the film like this. And I wanted very much to sketch this, but it's something important to say at this moment. As much as the film speaks about abortion, it's not necessarily a film about abortion for me. Abortion is an important part of it, but it's a lot of film about that period, and it's a lot of film for me about decision-making and responsibilities in life and freedom during that period, and compromise and friendship and solidarity. So I think that narrowing the discussion and talking too much about abortion is a way of not perceiving the film the way I intended.
The friend of the woman, the roommate of the woman who's having an abortion, goes through such extremes to help her friend through the abortion. And the friend doesn't seem all that comprehending and appreciative of what's been done for her. And I guess I'm wondering why the roommate is motivated to risk so much and to sacrifice so much for her friend.
I had to figure this out, because when you decide to make a story about a film about a true story, you know from the beginning that things happen like this. And the story came to me with all the details and with all the emotions, but not with all the motivations, because people don't know what why they acted the way they acted. They just acted in a, and reacted to a specific situation. And it was up to me to talk to these people and think about what happened and figure out why she decided like this. And it has to do with the situation, and it has to do with the kind of friendship that they were having. You know, whenever you have a very strong enemy in front of you and you have a problem which is common for a group of people, the solidarity belonging to that period is going to be much more important. And this was considered to be the most important problem that women were facing during that period. So they would help each other in a way which wouldn't necessarily happen today.
I've never lived in Romania, yet watching your film, I feel like you've captured a lot of the just kind of suspicion and paranoia and claustrophobia of that communist period under Nicolae Ceaușescu. Can we just talk about how the film looks a little bit? Like the dormitory rooms just seem so kind of like small and cluttered and claustrophobic. The hallways in all of the buildings that are shot are that like institutional two-toned colors of paint with like dirty linoleum floors. The outside shots, they're just kind of like dark and just depressing looking. I mean, everything just looks so colorless. What are some of your memories from that period that you visually wanted to put into the movie?
The most important thing for me was to render the atmosphere. There were too many films about communism in the last years, and each and every of them tries to tell a story from the perspective of somebody looking back and knowing that how it all ended. And you get to see people nostalgic about all the objects of the period and this kind of films. And I'm not interested really in this kind of filmmaking. What I wanted to do is to tell the story from the perspective of somebody living then. It made all the difference for me, because it's true to say that even in, let's say, 1987, which is like 2 years before the fall of communism, nobody had any idea that this is going to an end. And if you imagine that you're going to live forever under the communist regime and you're going to die under the communist regime, people were tending to make much more compromises. Nobody had any idea that this is going to an end. And I wanted very much to describe and to capture this atmosphere of gloominess, as you say, and of despair and of aggressivity that was present, and to describe the way in which, you know, people having this little authority on you would use it and abuse it very, very often. And I wanted very much to avoid using things which became cliché, like Ceaușescu and other words like communism and comrade and things like this, because we were not necessarily mentioning them. This is something that belongs to you as an author looking back today. And people living then were living like, you know, people having more problems but trying to apparently live normal lives. And this is why I avoided on purpose, and besides this indication at the beginning of the film which says 1987, there isn't actually any kind of indication about the period. It's only in the atmosphere. And we decided to make some very special things in order to render this lack of enthusiasm that people have for living. And for example, we decided from the beginning to shoot winter time and to use a specific laboratory process and to desaturate the colors in a process called bleach bypass, and to make the blacks very intense and to shoot these nights as much as possible with the existing light, just for the trying to render this atmosphere that everything is really very true.
So you desaturated the color, you drained the image of the color.
Yeah, what you see, it's a, you know, it's a digital intermediate, so finally we graded this in a computer and colors were desaturated just in an attempt of rendering the atmosphere of the period. And if you watch the film, there is no sun in the film, and we made big efforts to shoot everything without having any kind of sun. Because we thought that this is really matching that period. And we wanted to respect as much as possible the historical truth, and not only regarding the locations, because we shot locations, but also regarding the atmosphere and regarding the nights. And for example, I could afford to tell my cinematographer, because I know him quite well, he's a good friend of mine, that I want to try and respect what I remember to have been the atmosphere of the nights then, which is to say that we never had any kind of light outside. It was a shortage of everything in the last years of communism. So technically it was, I don't know, complete darkness. Of course, you can't shoot if there's complete darkness. But he invented some special devices, and he was carrying some China balloons on some special devices just to have a little bit of a glimpse of light on top of the characters. And you could somehow get a feeling about what was going on. You can't see much in the last 30 minutes, but still you get the atmosphere, and you feel the fear that this girl experiences.
Cristian Manju speaking to us from a studio in Romania. He'll be back in the second half of the show. His new film is called 4 months, 3 weeks, and 2 days. I'm Terry Gross, and this is Fresh Air. This is Fresh Air. I'm Terry Gross, back with Cristian Manju, the writer and director of the film 4 months, 3 weeks, and 2 days, which is gradually opening in theaters around the U.S. It won the top prize at the Cannes Film Festival last year. The film is set in Romania in 1987 and is about a college student who gets an illegal abortion and her roommate who helps her arrange it. The film takes place a couple of years before the fall of communist dictator Nicolae Ceaușescu, who had outlawed abortion and birth control. Manju is joining us from a studio in Romania. There's a black market that you show in the film, and one of the things the main character wants to get in the black market is Kent cigarettes.
Yes.
I have to say, I haven't seen anybody smoking Kent cigarettes in the United States for a long time. Were Kent cigarettes the thing in Romania?
It's not about the cigarettes. It's about what they meant. You know, having Kent cigarettes during that period was a social sign. It meant that you can afford the service that you were asking for. It's not about the cigarettes in themselves, and it's very difficult for everybody to mention why finally it was for the Kent cigarettes to have this role. If you ask me, but this is only a supposition, I believe that because they were white, they were different. You know, all the other cigarettes that were imported from Western markets, like, I don't know, Camel or Marlboro or whatever, looked pretty much like a regular Romanian cigarette, although they were way better. But the Kent cigarette, you know, meant aristocracy for people here. It was the sign of the free world that was present on the local market. And it became very much a local sign. You couldn't go to a doctor during that period without having a pack of cigarettes like this. And you couldn't get a room in a hotel unless you were paying, bribing that person or having a pack of cigarettes like this.
You mentioned that Kent cigarettes were white, and you know the paper on the filter part was white, whereas the paper on the filter part of most cigarettes was brown. So yeah, they really stood out and looked different.
And what is funny is that this habit stayed so much with the Romanians that even today there are old people that would go to a doctor, and this became a form of salute. They would offer him a pack of Kent, which is very funny because today this is like, I don't know, $2 here, and it doesn't have any meaning today. But still, it was preserved from that period.
In shooting the film, what did you have to do to give the interiors and exteriors the look that you were describing, that gloomy look? You mentioned the lighting, but I'm sure like the outsides of buildings and the streets have changed a lot since the end of communism in Romania.
Well, they changed a lot, but they haven't changed a lot in the sense that we have a lot of skyscrapers or anything like this. It's just that most of the buildings were repainted. The windows are different, are metal, new windows. There are a lot of air conditioning around now and a lot of advertising. This is the problem. It's like the locations were spoiled for making a period film. But at the same time, you know, it was important for us to try and shoot this film as much as possible in location. So what we did, we tried to discover if we can still find these buildings that still have the atmosphere of the period, and then we treated them as sets. For example, the student dormitory that you see at the beginning of the film, it was an empty room. So for us, it was important to just find a room that still looked like the rooms that I could remember from that period, and from that moment on, we just fill it with the objects that I remembered that were in all the students' room.
A lot of the scenes in 4 months, 3 weeks, and 2 days are shot in one take. And you might have like a 10-minute scene that's like one... It's like one shot. There isn't a lot of like editing within scenes. And often you just seem to like place the camera and the camera just like sees what's going on. There's one scene, for instance, in which the main character walks out of the frame and the camera just kind of sits still and waits for her to walk back in and nothing moves while she's gone. And I think by doing that, by having these like shots that last a long time, it helps convey how slowly time is moving in the movie, because there's so much kind of fear surrounding every movement and there's so much that needs to be done. Like, time has a real consequence, and time has a great weight to it. Is that part of what you wanted to do with those lengthy shots, to convey the passage of time and the threat of time? You know, that each second brings a new problem, and that some things are going to go very slowly before they resolve.
Well, there are a lot of things associated with using long takes, and one of them regards what you say, in so that there's something about the long takes that would signal to a spectator that this is true. This is happening in real time. There is no editing. There are no tricks. This emotion that you see in front of you takes its time. It's not edited. It's not like somebody preserved what were like the best moments of it. And you know what people feel without necessarily conceptualizing is that they are not being manipulated and being shown what's more important. Everything is there. The real time is there. That is the time of that scene. If the scene needed 10 minutes to develop, that is the time of that scene. And the regular kind of moments which would be cut out of a scene, in which somebody, as you say, would step off the shot and get back a few minutes later, are there. And this heightens the feeling that there's nothing to hide and there's no filmmaker behind. And this was the whole purpose of using these long takes for us. We thought that it's really important for a filmmaker from time to time to question all the formal decisions that he's making all the time. Very often because, you did this before and because you've seen a lot of films. But actually, if you start questioning these decisions and you check how many of them you make because the story requires you to make them and how many of them you just make out of habit, you see that you make a lot of things which are not necessarily required by the story. And you make a lot of formal decisions which are being very manipulative regarding the audience. And this is exactly what we wanted to do with the film, to have it as truthful as possible and make sure that we're not making any kind of manipulative decisions. This is why, for example, we decided not to use music from the beginning. And this is why we decided not to use editing. Because even a close-up signals you as a filmmaker behind, saying this is more important than a wider shot in which you would see all the action. And I will tell you, the spectator, that it's more important to see the tear dropping on her cheek. And this is something that we wanted to avoid. We wanted to have this perspective a little bit, if you want, as if in theater, in which I wouldn't tell you what's more important on this shot. I would just place the camera over there, try to capture as much as possible from the scene, and then it's up to you and up to your responsibility as a viewer to decide what's more important in the shot.
My guest is Christian Manju, the writer and director of the new film 4 months, 3 weeks, and 2 days. We'll talk more after a break. This is Fresh Air. My guest is Christian Manju, the writer and director of the film 4 months, 3 weeks, and 2 days. It's about a college student who goes for an illegal abortion in Romania in 1987, during the period the communist dictator Nicolae Ceausescu outlawed abortion and birth control. A lot of people are talking now about like a new wave of Romanian cinema, about really exciting films coming out of Romania. And the two examples most often offered are your film, 4 months, 3 weeks, and 2 days, and a slightly earlier film, The Death of Mr. Lazarescu. And your cinematographer is the same cinematographer who worked on that film. Did it take a long time in Romania after the fall of communism to have a good environment for filmmaking? The film industry was basically run by the state during the communist era, right?
Yes. I think we needed some 10 years to settle things a little bit. And the films that were made in Romania in the first 10 years were not really to be remembered too much. Although, lots of people made a lot of films about the communist period, for example, about the present period. But nothing really very special came out. And people speak about a new wave of Romanian filmmakers, mostly referring to the films that started to be selected in Cannes after 2001. And what was changed was that finally there was a new law regulating cinema, and this law created a clearer system. And little by little, they managed to put together a fund which is enough to help some 10 filmmakers to make films nowadays. But it's still somehow a state system in a way. It is an organism called the National Center for Cinematography that collects a tax mostly coming from advertising, but this is a state organism that collects this tax, and they organize a screenplay competition twice a year. If you manage to win this screenplay competition, you will get like half the budget that you need, but not more than, let's say, $400,000-$600,000. And you have to find the rest of it either in a co-production or on the local market from some other tax money which are destined for cinema. But there are no private money involved in the Romanian filmmaking. But still, somehow, this law gave the opportunity of more and more people every day to make their debut in cinema. And we started having films that were, first of all, remarked in festivals in Europe. And later on, what happened is that these films started getting important awards, especially in Cannes, and finally became quite successful from a commercial perspective, if you want. I mean, the films were bought by important sales agents and were sold theatrically to lots of territories. And I think people see this as a generation of filmmakers, mostly because it refers to filmmakers from 30 to 40, and because it doesn't involve a couple of names, a couple of filmmakers, but at least five or six different people.
Am I right in saying that you helped write that law that you were referring to, the new law about the film industry?
Well, yes, we got involved a lot, and I got involved a lot, and this helped us knowing how to use it. And we're trying to design a more logical way of funding here. And this gave finally the opportunity of more and more people to make their debut every year, so it helped.
Mm-hmm. So growing up during communism in Romania, what films did you see when you were young? What made the biggest impression on you, for better and for worse?
First of all, I think I got this desire of making films, mostly from watching some films that I didn't really like too much. And I refer to the Romanian films of the 80s, which were quite strange for us. We were very free and very, if you want, protesting adolescents, and we were having access to films and books from abroad. So whenever we were watching Romanian films, we had this feeling that they were involving people that look like us and apparently talk like us, but still behave like aliens. Nothing like that ever happened in real life. And because mostly, people had some problems with the propaganda in the system, but it was not necessarily this. I don't think they were encouraging the right people to make films. And very often these films didn't really expect a reaction, like a commercial reaction from the market. And watching these films and watching the kind of stories that they were placing in the films, you develop this idea that it wasn't complicated to make something better than these people. And the feeling that we got is that we need to get back to the story and to refer to reality and to get to tell stories about, having a real kind of a conflict.
What were some of the stories that were told in the propaganda films? Give us an example of those stories.
It wasn't like, there were like direct propagandistic films, which were funny because they were praising directly the system. But there was another kind of filmmaking. For example, there were films about a worker in a factory whose internal conflict was like this. He was the best guy in production, producing screwdrivers, and he wanted to work an extra shift to make help his company become the most important one in the competition among companies producing screwdrivers. But at the same time, he was the best football player of his factory. And this is the kind of conflict that he was having. And this was laughable, actually. Everybody knew that, you know, this is fake. This is not the kind of problems that people were facing in a country where, you know, you had to queue up for everything. And people had really, you know, a lot of dramas that they were caught in.
But he was trying to figure out whether he should play more football or do more at the screwdriver factory.
Yeah, this is the kind of drama that would motivate somebody to make a film.
So what made you want to make movies? You've described some really lousy movies to us. Why did you want to make them yourself?
Because I got this feeling that I can do way better, and because I felt that I'm a storyteller somehow, you know, from a very early age. I thought for a long period that I'm just going to express myself in words and write and become a writer. But later on, somehow seeing these films, the feeling that you got was that it's not too complicated to make, you know, way better films than these people, and they had no idea what they were talking about.
Had you seen good movies?
Yes, of course. But there were different periods. For example, in the 70s, the state would still have money to buy quite actual films of the period, and you could still see in regular theaters American and French films, mostly mainstream, but you could see them. And then it was a boom of the video period in the mid-80s up to the early 90s. Everybody was having kind of illegal VHSs with mostly American films. And that was a period in which, for example, I don't know, it was very often to see a couple of films per day. And that was my period when I've seen, I think, lots of mostly American and French films, modern.
So name a couple of the films that really influenced you a lot.
Well, for example, from the earlier films that were really impressing me and giving me a push to become a filmmaker, I remember Miloš Forman's early films before he left to U.S., The Love of a Blonde and the Fireman's Ball, and the films that he made in the late 60s in Czechoslovakia. And then there were the Keslovsky films that we could see, and there was Truffaut that I could see quite a lot. And the Bicycle Thieves and the films of the Italian neorealism, and Michalkov, that was quite popular during that period. And later on we discovered Altman and Miloš Forman's films that he made in the States. And way later on in the school I discovered Jarmusch, for example, and people that were making films at the same time with us without ever knowing about them.
What are movie theaters like now in Romania?
Well, actually, this is the biggest problem that we're having here, because this is the only important thing still owned by the state. Some 18 years have passed already, but still the state owns the theaters. And because the state is not really a very good manager, these theaters are in a very poor condition. And from having, I think, some 400 theaters in 1989, when there was the fall of communism, now I think we have less than 40 left in a country of 20 million.
40? So really that's so few theaters.
Yeah. So basically it's really the number of admissions have dropped from more than 20 million to less than 2 million. So it's very difficult to get a response from the market, and it's very difficult to get any kind of financial feedback from the market. This is why it's impossible to involve private money. And this is why, for example, Motivated... something very extreme that I decided to do with my film. I decided after Cannes to release this film myself, although this is not what I do normally, just as a way of fighting against not having cinemas over here. And I decided to use this kind of sympathy that people tend to have for me for the moment because of this Palme d'Or award that I got in Cannes. I fundraised all summer. I brought some important partners here. And we rented theaters all across Romania, and we brought a very high-quality technique from Germany, and we created a caravan that toured Romania for some 30 days, screening this film in 15 different big towns that don't have any theater left, just to see if people don't come to see films because there are no theaters or because they lost interest in seeing films.
Well, that's really interesting. So what kind of response did you get?
It was an unbelievable good response, and we decided, knowing beforehand that we were going to do this, to just record this on tape and produce a documentary in connection with this. And actually, this is going to become part of the bonuses that people will have on the DVD. The response was unbelievable, and lots of people crowded to see these films in these special screenings. And this became our most important argument in the fight that we're having now, and we're trying to stimulate somehow the Ministry of Culture in Romania and the government to give something back, because they got a very good image because of the films, the Romanian films in the last year. So I think it would be the right moment for them to get involved and try to do something about this release of films in Romania and trying to improve the system.
My guest is Christian Manju, the writer and director of the new film 4 months, 3 weeks, and 2 days. We'll talk more after a break. This is Fresh Air. My guest is Christian Manju, the writer and director of the Romanian film 4 months, 3 weeks, and 2 days. It's about a college student who goes for an illegal abortion in Romania in 1987, during the period the communist dictator Nicolae Ceausescu outlawed abortion and birth control. So I know you've gotten to see your movie 4 months, 3 weeks, and 2 days with a lot of Romanian audiences. I'm not sure if you've gotten to see American audiences watching your movie, but if you have, I'd be really interested if you could compare the reaction between American and Romanian audiences, because your movie is about getting an abortion during an era when it was illegal in Romania, not for moral reasons and not for religious reasons, but because Ceausescu wanted a larger Romanian population. So he didn't want birth control and he didn't want abortion. Abortion is such a kind of controversial subject in the United States, and so much of that revolves around the question of is it moral, is it ethical, and does it violate, religious practices. So what are the different reactions you've seen in America and in Romania from audiences watching your film?
It's important for me to tell you something else before this, connected with this moral issue. One of the reasons for which I decided to make this film regards especially this kind of moral issue. Because, as I told you, it is said that nearly 500,000 women died in the process of having illegal abortion from 1966 to 1989. But at the same time, after 1990, when abortion became legal again in Romania, we started having nearly 1 million abortions every year. Mostly because people didn't have any kind of education about this. So, you know, I thought that making this film for me was a way also about speaking about freedom and about how not having this freedom for such a long while or abusing this freedom for lack of knowledge once we had it could pretty much lead you in the same direction. And, you know, one of the best things that happened in US, the screenings where I've been, was that people finally understood that this film is not a political film. It doesn't tell you what to believe. It just signals to you that this is an important problem on which you need to have an opinion. And this is why the story is set then, because it speaks at the same time about what an abortion is and about what the consequences of forbidding it are. And I was very happy to see that finally the film was understood like this, that it doesn't carry conclusions, it doesn't carry preconceptions, it just tells a complex story, and this is what the film should do. It signals to you that as soon as you see this, in accordance to your own beliefs, you need to think about this and see what your opinion is.
One more question for you. You've made 4 months, 3 weeks, and 2 days without any music because you didn't want music to telegraph what somebody's supposed to be feeling. But there is music during the close credit sequence, and it's a duet. It's, you know, two people singing. And because it's sung in Romanian, I don't understand what's being said. So I'd be interested what the lyrics are about and why you chose to use that particular piece of music for the end of the film, for the close credits?
Well, it's mostly about the lyrics, but it's not all about the lyrics. For me, the credit is not directly part of the film, it's not directly part of the story. It's important to say, to signal to the spectators, that the convention is over. This is still a story that I told you about, and I wanted very much to avoid being over-dramatic. You can't really have the credits of a film on complete silence for 2 minutes. It's going to be very heavy, And we wanted to avoid being melodramatic all the time. So for me, it was important to end the film the way it ends. And I hope that the final shot of the film signals to you that now it's up to you to have an opinion. And there's a short silence, which gives you a few seconds to think about this. And then this music signals for me that for you as a spectator, the representation is off, the story is off, it's up to you. And the connection between that song and the film is indeed made by the lyrics. And I'm very happy that, you know, some of the people releasing the film had the idea of translating the lyrics. I think it happens in Japan now. Because the lyrics says something about this woman that mentions that she will all the time think about what she's seen and she will remember all the time that day. Probably she doesn't refer at all to what the film refers to. It's a song from the 70s, but it was really very accurate with what the film tells you.
Well, I want to thank you so much for talking with us.
Thank you.
Christian Manju wrote and directed the film 4 months, 3 weeks, and 2 days, which is gradually opening in theaters around the country. It's also being shown on IFC On Demand. Manju spoke to us from Radio Guerrilla in Bucharest, Romania. You can download podcasts of our show on our website, freshair.npr.org. Fresh Air's executive producer is Danny Miller. Our interviews and reviews are produced and edited by Amy Sallet, Phyllis Myers, Monique Nazareth, Joan Tui-Westman, Sam Brigger, Patty Leswing, Jonathan Menhivar, and John Sheehan. I'm Terry Gross. Here's the closing song from 4 months.
Repetând melodia pe care noi o cântam antrenat.
Timpul se noi căra și l-aș termen ca la ta, dar te va însoți mereu
ca o rază de lumină vocea ta. Te aștept noapte și zi.
Când acesta-i...